The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
We are now living through the most destructive arms race in human history, because this time includes artificial intelligence. And if there are no real security guarantees except friends and weapons, and if the world can't respond even to old threats, and if there is no strong platform for international security, will there be any place left on Earth that's still safe for people?
That was Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking last week at the United Nations General Assembly, warning we're now living through the most destructive arms race in history. But when it comes down to military capabilities, just what strengths do which countries have? Declan Power, defence and security analyst, joins me now. Declan, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. How are you?
I am looking at some of the charts, and there's no doubt that America it has the best offensive and defensive capability in the world and spends the most, which follows.
Absolutely. You are completely right there in that the US have spent a lot of time and energy developing the ability to... It's not just about numbers per se, it's about how you use them and technology as well. And the US has been developing its ability to fight wars on multiple fronts or on different continents at the same time. That has always been a central tenet of US defense philosophy, if you like, as well as strategy. And so even with that, though, however, there wouldn't be the biggest of world militaries. I think the Indians outnumber them, the Chinese. But it's not about numbers. And it's not even just purely about military resources. It's about your industrial base, your the framework, the economic framework of your society. We keep hearing a lot at times about Russia being on a war footing. It has moved its society and economy very much to a war footing. But it's still not... It still isn't on a scale, we'll say, to match the US or even Europe as a whole in that basis. Now, so there are a lot of other ingredients to military power.
The question of boots on the ground, and I saw recently an interview with a manufacturer of small drones in Ukraine, and he was talking about that the future of warfare is really about who has the best drones. You know, whether they're midget drones or huge drones, that's where it's going to be at. Whether boots on the ground will even be that relevant in the coming decades is an open question.
Pat, I'm always skeptical of statements like that. People have been saying things like that for a long time whenever new developments came in. Back in the 90s, you had what became known as the RMA, the Revolution of Military Affairs, where various theorists were claiming that the surge in software development for military capacity was changing the battlefield. And it did. These things undoubtedly do change battlefield management and various applications. But let's go back just to look at the most pressing war for us in Europe at the moment, which is in Ukraine. And it's, you know, they're fighting parts of that war the same way as our great-grandfathers and grandfathers did in the First World War. So technology changes things, but it doesn't. No one technology becomes the dominant thing. An old saying, you know, the war isn't won until the infantryman, you know, piles through, wins the firefight, and sticks his bayonet into the enemy.
And of course,
at the end of the day, it boils down to that.
We're going to see this, we expect, in Gaza City when the Israelis get in and it gets granular, I suppose, rather than at the moment they'll evacuate people from an apartment building and then destroy it. And the idea is to leave whoever's left for Hamas nowhere to hide. But eventually it will get down to face-to-face combat.
Pat, you're absolutely right. And this is one of the things that led to unprecedented exchanges in public between senior Israeli Defense Force officers, including their chief of staff, and Benjamin Netanyahu himself and some of his more aggressive elements within the government. Curiously, just a brief aside, which include people from the Orthodox Israeli background and who represent the settlers, such as Ben-Gavir and Bezalel Smotrich, who represent a constituency who refused to do military service. in Israel, but yet they're among the most bellicose voices. But to come back to your point, this is one of the things the Israeli military fear most. When you flatten those buildings in Gaza, as an example, when you use your superior firepower, as the Israelis have been doing, indiscriminately but lethally, it still requires the Israelis to put ground troops in because Hamas have prepared for this, and they have an underground network of tunnels which allow them to be extremely resilient in withstanding the Israeli forces. So the Israelis know they will have to winkle them out. They have to engage in what's known as fighting in a built-up area. And that kind of warfare, that urban warfare, is extremely high attrition. And it requires a level of resilience and skill that is quite different from fighting in open ground. Mm. And so that's where, and then when you do that, you then have to maintain your footprint, your presence there, and you need a lot of troops to do that, as the Americans learned when they tried to do it on the cheap post the Iraq War.
Now, Europe rearming, and we know that the instigator of much of this is Donald Trump by saying, you know, Europe, you've got to defend Ukraine. And Ukraine, his latest statement last week was, Ukraine, you can win with the help of Europe. Not much help from me, but you can win. And Zelensky warning about rearmament all around. And where will there be a safe place for anyone to be? If you're going to flee, is there anywhere safe to flee to?
Yeah, I would reinterpret that. Safety does not come from fleeing. Your lack of safety, your insecurity comes from you're developing that mentality. History has taught us that appeasement, the mentality of fleeing, running, hiding, looking for some sort of a magic bullet or elixir to solve the problem, only emboldens aggressors. What does work, and what has been proven to work since the end of the Second World War, is building an effective deterrent. This is the concept that Europe has been built around, but that has been successful. But the problem now, and you've put your finger on it, is that was built around American engagement. For a long time, the edict that there is no European security without American assistance, and there is no world stability without European and American cooperation, is now being put to the test. And it's not the case, thankfully, that it seems the Americans are, at one stage there was a real concern in Europe that the Americans were nearly going to pull out unilaterally. But I think we in Europe now have come to the conclusion that we can't completely rely on them. And while it's interesting that Donald Trump also referred to the EU rather than NATO when he talked about support for Ukraine, and what that reminds us is that NATO is still built around a largely American-led command and control system, and that's what makes it work. So NATO certainly is a much more effective and efficient military concept to contain Russia. But the reason Russia is pushing out now at the moment and probing, it's like a soldier crawling across no man's land, probing for weak points in the line, because they know that they can't take on NATO ordinarily. But a NATO denuded of American support, of which would ordinarily have been unquestioned, is a different concept. And so Trump is still supplying weapons to NATO for Ukraine, but he very much disassociates himself. And so on one hand, his statements say, "Well, we'll continue to supply weapons to NATO, and you know, whatever they do with them, they do with them," kind of thing. there is this little bit of a distance support, but from a distance, diminished support. So Europe is looking at having to build a new concept, a new form of deterrence. One aspect of that is very much down to, going back to your point about drones, it's, you know, those who have the most drones, as you were saying earlier, are the most, I would argue, that can be countered by those who develop the most effective technology to defend against drones. And this is where Europe is looking at, you know, particularly the Baltic states and those European states that abut Russia, to develop a defensive mechanism, including electronic countermeasures, more old-fashioned air defense artillery methods, to be able to ensure that drones don't penetrate. Then there is also the Germans looking to develop a shield, a European anti missile defense shield. And these are things that require a mixture of not just military approaches, but political unity and economic contribution. And this is where deterrent can come from, as well as building up
now,
forces.
Now, we know that Russia is involved in what they call hybrid warfare, which is not just on the battlefield. It's intelligence, it's hacking, it's interfering in the IT security of not just military installations. They try that, and that might be hard, but things that are softer in terms of civilian infrastructure, they're doing that, and including interfering with the voting machinery of various states. They've been trying it in Moldova, and interestingly, they have failed.
Yes, all credit to the Moldovans. They exist in a very difficult neighbourhood. Their pro-European party appear to have won the recent election. And that's not without substantial disinformation activities by the Russians. The Moldovan police had warned about the high level of disinformation activities. The Russians also attempted to push en masse people who held Moldovan passports. Well, they're actually Moldovans. They live in a place called Transnistria, which is a sliver of Moldova that has been occupied by Russian troops for some years now, and that the European Union consider it to be an occupying power, as do the Moldovans. So it's a real attempt to destabilize them. And this comes back to the heart of the matter, in that in understanding the Russian threat, we need to remember that they're more than aware themselves that they really don't have, at this point in time, thankfully, the ability to go head-to-head in a conventional kinetic war with Western Europe. But they do have the ability, and they are very good at it, to destabilize us through a mixture of means, which is, as you referred to, hybrid warfare. And Moldova is a frontline area with regards to, and not just Moldova, but also the Czech Republic is also suffering a level of disinformation. Basically, any European country facing elections over the coming period will be subject to this kind of attempt to polarize within society and to destabilize, because Russia realizes that what it lacks in conventional military capability, it can make up for by multiplying its abilities to cause political disunity. And political disunity is more or less to hollow out European resolve and resilience from the inside out.
It's interesting that following in both the Putin and Trump playbooks, Igor Dodon, who's the pro-Russian opposition in Moldova, even before there were any exit polls or anything, he jumped up and went on television saying, "We won." And they didn't. They lost handsomely. But that's the kind of thing that, that goes on. Tell the public we've won and then cast doubt on the validity of the election.
But when you think about it, it's very it's a very clever, low risk in a way and low cost strategy. He didn't have any proof. Dodon went on television. He started making these bellicose and ridiculously over the top statements that they'd won. Wasn't citing anything to support this, and you know, he was creating a bulwark of a narrative for primarily his own supporters to galvanize them, but to the world in general, because what we're learning now about this pattern is there's a lot of time and effort and being put into researching the effects of disinformation. It's not about having your facts marshaled anymore. It's about whoever shouts loudest. And if they keep shouting it, if you keep throwing enough mud at the wall, some of it's going to stick. And the people who design these things have realized that simplicity of message is what works best. And you're not going to convert everybody. You're certainly not going to convert those who are completely at odds and who are well fortified with the facts. But you will convert bystanders, maybe. You will convert a certain percentage. And that's what they're looking at. The Russian approach to disinformation is quite clever. They're not thinking about you or I, but maybe they're thinking about countries in the global south that might be influenced by this, or other parts of European states with Russian-speaking or ethnic Russians within their borders. And if they can motivate them to engage in acts of defiance against their own governments or acts of disobedience, well, that's a win.
Declan Power, defence and security analyst. Declan, thank you very much for joining us. And I wonder, who do the Russians want to win our presidential election? Do they want Jim Gavin or Catherine Connolly or Heather Humphreys? Who knows?
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.